On the Go Media proudly presents Between the Ropes with your hosts, Colt Powers and Hunter Dietz.
Welcome back to Between the Ropes. My name is Hunter Dietz. This is Colt Powers. And today we have the Gordon Solie Award winner this year, the 2026 George Tragos Luthez Professional Wrestling Hall of Fame in Waterloo, Mr. Ken Resnick. Ken, how are you doing today?
I'm doing good, Hunter and Colt. Thank you so much for having me. It's an honor to be on with you two.
We appreciate that.
We're happy to hear that. Just as much a dream for us as it is for you. And normally we'd start off asking about how you got involved in the wrestling business, but I want to take it back just a little bit further because you told me something on the phone the other day that I think not many people know about. You happen to share a high school with someone very interesting, don't you? Who was that you went to the same high school as?
When I found out I was going to be the Gordon Solie honoree going into the Hall of Fame, just being me, I thought I knew who Gordon was. I had never met him. I'd seen tapes, and he is certainly one of the greatest wrestling announcers, if not the GOAT. So I just went online to, out of curiosity, to learn a little bit more about him. And he and I, years apart, I'm old but not that old, attended the same high school here in Minneapolis, Minneapolis Southwest High School, and I was just amazed at that. I didn't even know he had spent time in Minneapolis, let alone we went to the same high school.
Yeah, wow. I mean, that's about a coincidence.
I was going to say, that's really cool to be able to find that out, that you guys were in the same school, so that's awesome.
And so...
And I'm guessing, unbeknownst to Minneapolis Southwest, they're probably the only high school in the country that'll have two Tragos Thez Hall of Fame announcers.
I think you're right. Once you start to leave high school, though, you started working for KTTC in Rochester, right?
Right. I went to Drake University, graduated, and it's an amazing story. I had no background in broadcasting whatsoever. Never went to broadcasting school. My major at Drake University in Iowa, so I've got a lot of ties to Iowa. I majored in political science, international relations, and minored in secondary ed. But a really good friend of mine was a sports director here in the Twin Cities. Moved to Cleveland. We stayed in touch. I went to visit him. And then he came back to work for another station. And he called me and he said, hey, can you get a couple days off? His station was doing the state high school basketball tournament. He said, will you, keep stats and kind of, feed me things throughout the game? I wasn't going to be on camera or anything. And I said, sure, it'd be fun. Great seats for the tournament. Well, the first game of the first day was kind of a run and gun. So it ended earlier than TV-wise they had time budgeted. So Tom said to me, quick, put your sport coat on. They came back to a two-shot. The two of us kind of went over, digested the first game, what had happened, and then previewed the second game. And then, went to commercial and they got ready to start to the second game. And the producer liked the two of us together. They started using me between games on camera and at halftime. So I did the three games and I'm thinking, this was great. I could say once made my, was on television. Went back to work. I was a sales manager for Chrysler Corporation. And about a week later, my friend called and said, you ever thought about a career in TV? And I was kind of laughing. He said, no, I'm serious. I got a call from our NBC affiliate in Rochester, wanted to know who you were. They like you so much on screen, they'd like you to come down and audition for the sports director's job. And I said, did you tell them I had no background? He said, I did. They still want you to audition. I went down and I auditioned. I had no background in production, no background in anything. And about a week and a half later, they called and offered me the job as sports director.
Goodness.
So it was a happenstance.
That's awesome.
And so your background as a sports fan, I mean, obviously to be working in sports, you were a sports fan growing up, I'm guessing. Were you a wrestling fan at all, too?
I was very much a sports fan. In fact, as a child growing up, couldn't afford tickets to all the games. So the first job I ever had was selling hot dogs as a vendor at Metropolitan Stadium so I could see the Twins and the Vikings.
Awesome. Wow, that's cool. Awesome.
So you get to work and get to watch the game a little bit. There you go.
Well, I mean, Colton, it was great because as a vendor, you know, when something really big was happening, you know, runners on base, you know, the fans wouldn't be looking to buy a hot dog. They'd be watching the game.
Yeah.
So you could just turn around, kneel down, and watch all the big plays as well. It finished the inning, you know, you could go back and sell hot dogs. So it's great making money and seeing all the games.
That's awesome. I love it.
Yeah, that's great. You're working for KTTC. How does that sort of parlay? I know there's something involving a celebrity golf tournament. How does that kind of become your introduction into the AWA?
There was a huge celebrity golf and tennis tournament that they held in the Twin Cities called Duff's Celebrity Golf and Tennis Tournament, obviously. And they decided, and they really got big names over the years. One year they had the cast of MASH. One year they had the cast of Hill Street Blues, Lonnie Anderson. So they would be like 20, 25,000 fans coming out to it. And they got the idea that, you know, fans didn't really have a chance to interact with the celebrities while they were playing. They said, let's have a sound stage where the celebrities can get interviewed so the fans can at least get to know them a little better and feel like, you know, they saw them, but really, you know, at a distance, had a chance to meet them. And a friend of mine was a big car dealer here. His name was Jim Lubian, called and he said, hey, we're doing this. I want you to interview the celebrities. And I said, hey, count me in. And they were, you know, all coming through and we had a big sound stage. Well, and one of the celebrities that came through after he finished playing, he'd been playing tennis, was Vern Gagne. And growing up, you know, in Minneapolis, yeah, I watched All-Star Wrestling like a lot of people did. I mean, I liked it. I wasn't a huge fan. I'd, you know, gone to matches. Well, when Vern came up, because I watched it, you know, I was able to do a little bit more of a probing, intelligent interview, asking him, you know, about the matches coming up, you know, some of the other talent, which I think caught him a little bit by surprise that, you know, I kind of went that direction, let him plug the next card, but, you know, when he was going to defend his title, and then that was that. He went off, you know, I did more interviews. Well, at the party that night, Vern came up to me and said, geez, you know, I want to thank you. That was a really great interview. You know, tell me about your background. And, you know, I told him and where I was working. And, you know, that was it. And then about 2 weeks later, he called me down at the television station and said, do you ever get back to the Twin Cities? And I said, I come up every weekend. I had worked it out with the news director. After I did the sports, I could take off and start heading up to hit last call with my buddies at Bennigan's in the cities. I said, so I come up every single weekend. And he said, well, are you coming up this weekend? I said, yeah, absolutely. He said, how about why don't you meet me for lunch? And I'm going, I'm like, huh? And we had a very nice lunch. And at the end of lunch, he said, how would you like to come work for me? And a little bit of a backstory. Prior to that, I'd been director of public relations for the new Minnesota Fighting Saints in the old WHA. And then when that team folded, I went up and did it and lived in Calgary, Alberta with the Calgary Cowboys. So he really liked the fact that I knew public relations and marketing, knew television, knew post-production. And that's how it worked out. And he offered me a job to work in the office. And, you know, Gene Okerlund was still there at the time.
Oh.
And he said, you know, Gene's going to be our main interviewer, but I want to start working you into some of the smaller markets to turn you into an on-air personality. And I had done some high school football, you know, on the radio. I had done, in fact, the first job in broadcasting I ever had, I did the Herb Brooks show when Herb was coaching the University of Minnesota on a radio station. So he liked all that, and that's how I came up. And not too long after I started, Gene left for the WWF, so suddenly I was kind of the main guy.
Oh, wow.
Wow. That's quite a quick trajectory. You probably couldn't have predicted a few months before going from, you know, covering this celebrity golf tournament, getting to meet Vern Gagne, and then all of a sudden you're replacing Gene Okerlund. You're with the AWA for a few years.
About 3.5 years.
Yeah, yeah. And so, obviously, a lot of great talent coming in and out of that area. I wanted to ask you specifically, though, because I don't think we've ever actually talked to anyone who had a story. Do you have any stories about the Road Warriors? Because they were there during that time, weren't they?
Yep, I do. In fact, you know, I've seen Paul Ellering in a number of events, and he reminded me of the story. The Road Warriors had been in Japan, and they came back. I'd been there, you know, doing all the interviews a couple months. They got to TV late because they had just flown in. And as soon as they got there, they wanted them to start doing interviews, like, immediately. So I hadn't even had the chance to introduce myself to Paul or Animal or Hawk, and they come in, you know, they've got the spikes and the makeup and everything, and suddenly I think Greg was running the interviews, Greg Gagne, and he said, okay, we're Denver in 2 weeks, they're going up against it, and go. And, you know, Paul Ellering comes in, and Animal and Hawk and whatever. And I hadn't met them, so those guys can be a little intimidating. Everyone else, before I had done interviews, they knew I was working in the office. I had met them at television. So, you know, we had a bit of a bond established. And, you know, I was definitely intimidated. And Paul Ellering was smart enough, and he didn't do it in a way to put me down. He kind of did it in a way to relax. So when Animal and Hawk are growling, Paul says to me, let me ask you something. You know why God gave you a nose? And I'm going, no. And he said, so you could breathe through it and keep your big mouth shut. And he took most of the interview, and then I relaxed a little and, you know, eventually got back. But it was a couple of years ago, it was at an event in Charlotte, North Carolina called The Gathering, which is a phenomenal event. And they have a night to remember where they honor some of the real greats with an award. And I was emceeing it, and they were honoring, unfortunately, posthumously, the Road Warriors in terms of Animal and Hawk. But Paul was there, you know, and I introduced him, and he came up and, you know, presented him with the plaque. And I started to walk down, and he said, hey, wait a minute. Do you remember the first words I ever said to you? And I said, I absolutely do. And he said, what were they? You asked me why God gave me a nose and told me it was so I could keep my big mouth shut. And we laughed, but he remembered that all, you know, like 30 years later.
That's awesome. That's awesome.
That's great. I know, obviously, you remember the Road Warriors.
Oh,
you,
God, yeah.
Yeah, that much. I'm a little bit younger. I never got to see the Road Warriors in action, but I mean, even around the time that, you know, you were a teenager, they had come back in LOD 2000 and stuff like that, and Paul, and obviously, I mean, it's just a legendary team, and we see the birth of a lot of legends in the AWA. Obviously, Hulk Hogan comes from the AWA. Do you have any Hulk Hogan stories?
I got along great with Hulk. He had used it just a little bit in the AWA, but he had left to go to the WWF, and I ended up going there. And the first interviews for every market, he just put me over like a million. Said there is no more Ken Resnick. From now on, you're Killer Ken, and that's what he called me for the entire time. And fans use that today. And I'd gotten to be, pretty good friends with Hulk. And it was common knowledge towards the end, while Hulk was still in the AWA, that Vince was really pursuing him, for a significant more money than, he was able to get, or anyone was for that matter, in the AWA. And we were talking one day, and he was vacillating back and forth. And I said, what's holding you back? I mean, the AWA, in the Midwest was the best. But Vince had the talent and money and was taking it nationally. And you'll be interested, he said, because Vern can still give me the one thing Vince can't. And I said, what? He said, time off. Because in the AWA, generally, they would fly out, like they would do a town Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, come back late Sunday night, have Monday off. Tuesday was our TV interview day. They would have Wednesday off, and then they would generally take off Thursday afternoon to do a weekend of shows. And that's, obviously he ended up going, but that was the one thing he was debating, because he knew if he went to Vince, he'd be like 28 days a month.
Yeah.
Or more.
Yeah.
So ended up.
So then you kind of alluded to it, but you're leaving the AWA for the WWF. Was that a similar thing? Was it just there was a bigger contract offered, or were there other things going on?
I'm glad you asked, Hunter, because there's kind of a misnomer out there. It was right after, in fact, my last day of the AWA was after Wrestle Rock, and the infamous Wrestle Rock Rumble video. And it was time, for me. And in fact, I had already talked to Chrysler, and they were very interested in bringing me back as in a sales manager capacity. So I kind of thought, I'm going to leave, did Wrestle Rock, take a couple weeks off, and then go back to work in the corporate world. And that's who I was. And Wrestle Rock was on a Sunday night, and Monday night, Blackjack Lanza called me. And Jack and I had worked together in the office and were really, really close. In fact, the three people in the industry I was closest with away from the industry, that knew my family, knew my mom, we did things totally unrelated to wrestling, was Blackjack Lanza, Adnan El Casey, and Sergeant Slaughter. So Jack had now left Vern, and he was a road agent for WWF. And he called me the following night, not looking for any inside info or anything, just wanted to know, what the finishes were, what kind of crowd, how the crowd reacted to Waylon Jennings. And we talked for a while, and he said, well, anything else happened? I said, no, not really. And I said, well, I quit, I'm done. And he didn't believe me. And I said, no, Jack, I really did. And he said to me, well, what are you going to do? I said, I'm taking a couple of weeks off, and then I'm probably going to go back to work for Chrysler Corporation. He said, look, I get back home Wednesday. We'll get together. Don't do anything, you know, till you know, we get together. And he came back, and he called me Wednesday night, and he said, listen, you know, we'll have breakfast tomorrow. I said, okay, great. He said, I'll pick you up at 6 a.m. And he said, wear a coat and tie. And I, like, started laughing. I said, Jack, you don't think I know a rib when you're trying to pull one? He's thinking he's going to get me up at 6, you know, 5 o'clock in the morning, get all dressed up in a coat and tie, and he'll still be in bed. And he said, I'm serious. Vince wants to see you. We're going to New York. And I said, Jack, I've known you too long. You know, great idea for a rib, but I'm not buying it. He said, I'll tell you what, call Northwest Airlines and you ask them if there's not two prepaid tickets on the like 7:40 a.m. flight to LaGuardia. And there was. And that's how it happened. I flew out with Jack. They had a limo waiting for us at LaGuardia, took us both up to the office in Stanford. Jack was doing his thing. And it was like, I interviewed, I don't know, you know, the order. I interviewed with Pat Patterson. I interviewed with Arnie Skolan. I interviewed with Terry Garvin. It was kind of like everyone would interview me and then they'd take me back to the lobby. And then someone else, like whoever interviewed, then went to the next guy and said, you know, I think this guy's all right. And eventually I got into, after Arnie Skolan, I got in to see Vince. I was in about a little over an hour with him and he offered me a job.
That's awesome.
So
a lot of people say, you know, Vince tried to steal me like a lot of the other talent, and that wasn't true. I had already left before I'd had any contact.
So what's that first meeting with Vince like? We hear that Vince is quite the intimidating character.
This story's out there. I've told it a few times. I come in and meet, you know, Vince, and we're talking. And about 2 minutes into the meeting, he says, tell me about your mustache. And I'm like, huh? He says, tell me about your mustache. And I'm thinking, well, it's above my lip, below my nose. He said, no, I mean, when did you grow it? Is it a big deal to you? And I said, I grew it my freshman year in college. I've had it ever since. I mean, you know, I like it. I'm not married to it. And Vince says, you know, I know Oaks has got a mustache, but on announcers, I hate facial hair. I hate it. And then he stopped. And I said, well, are you asking me if everything worked out? Would I shave it? Yes, I would shave it. And then he just went on and we talked wrestling, we talked life, all these things for close to an hour. And then he just stopped. He looked at me and he goes, if I would offer you so much, which was significantly more than I'd been making, when would you be available? And I looked at my watch and I said, well, it's like 2:25. We could round it up to 2:30. He didn't say a word, just stared at me, opened up his top desk drawer, pulled out a razor, a can of shaving cream, and said, bathroom's right through that door. Really, I went in and shaved the mustache, and I came back out, and he said, let me see. I had a towel, you know, it was a straight edge, so there was some blood, and I was blotting it. And he looked at me, and he goes, you know, I actually liked you. Go with it. Go put it back on. And I just said, you know, really, why would I say anything? And he kind of laughed and he said, you just showed me something I value. When you say something, you back it up. And he looked at the calendar. He said, you'll start Saturday in Detroit.
Wow.
That's how it happened.
That's so cool. That's great. Awesome.
That's great. Once you got into the WWF, do you have any particular memories of maybe an event you enjoyed covering or someone you really liked talking to?
Well, I can share this one with you. My first day, and I went to Detroit, and they just kind of introduced me. I didn't really start doing interviews. My first interview day, was at the Providence Civic Center, Providence, Rhode Island, and it was a Saturday night main event. Gene was doing the interviews for the Saturday night main event, and I was doing, you know, starting to do the other markets, because back then, everything was market specific. There was no, you know, superstations or cable TV, that on interview days, you sometimes needed to do 75 interviews. Mm-hmm. So I'm starting to do these interviews, and I'm in a room, and there, you know, Vince, George Scott, Arnie Skolin, Pat Patterson, Terry Garvin, the Macho Man, Roddy Piper, you know, none of these guys I've met. And I was very intimidated. I mean, I sucked. And I'm thinking, I'm going to get fired on my first day. I mean, I was just tense. I didn't really know these people. And back in the AWA days when we do interviews, as we didn't rehearse anything, but sometimes the interview just didn't turn out very good, or right in the middle of it, it was obvious. And Vern had this habit where he would, you know, interrupt the interview, and he would like pound his forehead. Jesus, what are you guys thinking? And you know, we would always crack up. So I'm in the middle of my fifth or sixth interview, which is just not going well. I mean, I'm nervous, I'm intimidated, you know. Like you said, Vince has a reputation, and he's right in the front staring at me. And all of a sudden, Bobby Heenan interrupts the interview. I forget who it was with, but Bobby comes in. Jesus Christ, what are you doing? He's pounding this, and I crack up. I'm laughing. And everybody else is going like, what the hell is he doing? What is going on? I'm laughing, and Bobby just whispers in my ear, come on, you got it. And after that, I was fine.
That's so cool.
Florida saved my job, I think.
That's such a cool story. And everything for how great Bobby was on air, everything we've heard about him off air too, just the best.
Beyond the best. I don't know if in the history of wrestling there had ever been someone that was 180 degrees opposite of what he was in real life, like Bobby Heenan.
Yeah.
And you know, I often say, I mean, Bobby behind the mic was incredible, but he was so good, people forget what a great wrestler in the ring he was.
Yeah.
That I don't think he gets the credit for being how good he was in the ring, because he was so great as a manager.
Yeah.
And, you know, coming in to the AWA, I got to be, as I mentioned, very good friends with Jack Lanza, because we worked together in the office. Well, Jack and I were in charge of running the small towns around Minnesota, you know, not the big ones, but like, you know, state fairs, we'd run Rochester, we'd run Duluth, St. Cloud. And so we would drive to the shows ahead of time, obviously, to make sure everything was set up. But oftentimes, like, we'd be, you know, Jack and I, we'd ride with Nick and Bobby and Crusher and Mad Dog, you know, and they're talking the business. And, you know, I'm still one of those that you can always learn more with your ears than your mouth. So I'm just sitting there soaking it up. And you know, they would talk about something and I'd ask a question and I'm going, how lucky am I to be learning the business from the likes of Lanza, Heenan, Bockwinkle, Crusher, Mad Dog, and learning why the psychology behind when they do things. So, you know, I mean, getting a chance to learn it that way was just unbelievable.
That's amazing. That is amazing. Being able to ride with those guys and learn, like you said, learn under that learning tree. I mean, that's just all-star teachers right there.
I'll give you a great Bobby Heenan story, because Bobby was so quick. We were running Duluth, and after the show, you know, we're driving back. And to give you an idea, about midway between the Twin Cities and Duluth is a town called Hinckley, Minnesota. A Grand Casino is now there. And there's a restaurant there called Toby's. which is known for these cinnamon rolls that are like the size of a cake. So, and they're open all night. So we pull in at like, you know, 11:30, quarter to 12, we're gonna have coffee and cinnamon rolls. Well, decades before Hinckley had all been destroyed by what is known as the Great Hinckley Fire. I mean, it was tragic. People lost everything, lives were lost. So we're sitting there, the waitress brings the coffee and cinnamon rolls. And, you know, Bobby said, boy, these cinnamon rolls are great. You know, this is really great. Hinckley is just this wonderful town. Do you have any souvenirs or anything, you know, like pieces of charred wood? That was right, just out of the clear blue. And the waitress doesn't know who we are. Not really. She's like going, you're bringing up the fire. That was Bobby.
Oh, man. What a guy.
In fact, another great Bobby story. I had just started with WWF, and we were running a show here in Minneapolis at the Met Center. So my mom was coming with a couple people. I'd got tickets, and, you know, I got her a pass. Security was much tighter in WWF. But, you know, I said, show them the pass and come down at intermission. You know, it was just going to introduce her, you know, to some people. So, you know, she's in her room, and I had told Hulk came in, and, of course, Jack came in. And he knew her very well. And then Bobby came in. She'd never met him. And I said, Bobby, I want you to meet my mom. And he goes, oh, great. Another freebie ticket. Anybody, you ever bring anybody in here that buys a damn ticket? And my mom was like, horrified. And he starts laughing. He said, I'm just kidding, and went up and gave her a big hug. But that was Bobby. He never missed a chance to pull a rib. And that. I will give you the rib that Bobby pulled on me, one of the best. We were in Pittsburgh in doing a full day of interviews. We'd flown in the morning. And they would always send me the interview rundown ahead of time in case something happened. And I forget who the agent was that day, that from the office that would always run the interviews and had the full list of everything that needed to get done. But his plane was late. I'd gotten in early, and I left my rundown in my room. And, you know, it was a ways. We were at the Pittsburgh Civic Center, and we stayed right out by the airport. So I'm trying to think who would still be there. And I thought to myself, Bobby. Well, I called Bobby, and he was still there. And I said, look, Bobby, the list is right on the little desk in the room. I forgot it. I'm going to call the desk and have them give you a key to pick up and bring the list. And I do that, and I hang up, and I'm going, I just gave an unsupervised Bobby Heenan the key to my hotel room. So Bobby comes down, gives me the list, and I said, just tell me now, what did you do? Yeah. Said, oh, come on, you know, this was different. And, well, I wouldn't do anything like this. You know, you needed the list. I got it. I came right down. I didn't do anything. I wouldn't do anything. And he's swearing by this. So the show's over, I get back to the hotel, you know, I put the key in the door, and I'm opening it like 1 inch at a time. I'm expecting a bucket to come down, whatever, get the door open, nothing. So now I go in, I check the bathroom, it's like the curtain was, I'm afraid to like open the curtain, I have no idea what might be in, nothing. Now I go over and I'm pulling the dresser drawers out an inch at a time, bringing in, they're upside down and there's something inside, nothing. I can't find anything. Look under the bed, nothing. And I go, son of a gun, he really kept his word. And I go down to the bar and Bobby's there. I said, Bobby, let me buy you a drink. I appreciate it. He said, I told you I wouldn't do anything. That wouldn't be a rib. So we have a couple drinks, you know, go back because we're getting up early. So I go back to the room, you know, take my contacts out, brush my teeth, get ready. And, you know, I get in bed. At the top of my lungs, I scream, Heenan! And he's knocking, he knocks on the door. I hear him laughing, and he runs away. Bobby had gone to the restaurant and gotten about 3 salt shakers, gone in, pulled the white sheets back, and poured salt all on the inside of the bed, and then made the bed again. That's how creative you are.
That's a pretty good one.
That's a pretty good one.
He got me good, and he knew it would be a while because he was standing outside the door waiting to hear my reaction.
Oh, God, that's good. That's awesome. I do want to continue going through your career, but before I do, I've been talking a lot. Do you have any questions right off the top of your head?
No, I'm enjoying the stories. We don't get too much for Bobby Heenan stories yet, so I'm very much enjoying these. We kind of answered my curiosity was how you kind of got started in it, and taking you up through the WWF days, I'm sitting here enjoying. Similar to what you said, learning with my ears open and my mouth shut has been the best way, and I truly enjoy the stories and listening. So I don't have any questions yet.
Hunter Colt's just being nice. He was bored out of it. Yeah. Actually, I've got one more great Heenan one. We had done a show at the Boston Garden, and then we were coming here and doing a show in Minneapolis the next night. So I took like a 6:20 a.m. flight because it would give me a chance to come home, do laundry, do some things, and then go to the show because we were flying out again the next day. So I get to the gate, and there's Bobby. And because, Bobby and Cindy, used to live here, so he wanted to come back and see some friends, may have still had the house. So we were both on, and it was a wide-body DC-10 that, there maybe was 50 people on. First class that they had upgraded us was completely empty. So Bobby and I are sitting in the window and aisle, on the DC-10s, it was 2-3-2. And we're sitting there. And Bobby is staring. There's a gentleman on the far row by the window. Bobby keeps, Bobby's in the window, I'm in the aisle. And Bobby, we're talking, and he keeps looking and looking and looking. And, Bobby says, shh. All of a sudden he's, oh, shh, I'll be right back. And he goes around. The guy had fallen asleep and nobody was in front of him. He had taken his shoes off, pushed them ahead, the shoes were behind him, but his feet were stretched out. So Bobby runs around, makes sure the flight attendants are in coach serving drinks. He lays down, puts his arm out, and takes one of the shoes. And he goes back about 4 rows and puts it up in the overhead bin. So this guy's sleeping, all of a sudden they wake up, we're getting ready to land, and he's looking all around. He can't find his shoe anywhere. Bobby's cracking up, and we walk by him to get off, and he says, "Geez, are you okay? Everything all right?" He said, "I can't find my shoe." And Bobby said, "I don't have a good luck." And that was him. He was like, he saw an opportunity, and he was not going to be denied a rib on some guy. And, I imagine eventually they go through and open all the overheads, so he probably found it. But that was just Bobby Heenan.
Oh, man. Gone too soon, Bobby Heenan. What a great great mind for the business, and just a great guy. I want to get back to your WWF career. It says on my sheet here that your final television appearance as a WWF announcer was on the March 14th, 1987 episode of Wrestling Challenge. What led to you leaving the WWF and continuing to explore other opportunities?
The biggest thing, and I kind of knew, they brought me in because Gene, I think, had some health issues, and he just took a lot of time off. And then Gene was ready to come back. And, even though they still paid me through my contract, I kind of knew it's like, you're the starting quarterback, you're the backup quarterback that's now playing, but you know the starting quarterback at some point is going to get healthy.
Yeah.
So that was it. And then after they still, that was probably the final interview, but they still used me a lot. I did color. Gorilla and I always used to say we were on the garden tour. We did the Boston Garden, Madison Square Garden, and Maple Leaf Gardens.
That's great. Well, and so you got to work with Gorilla some too. How was it working with Gorilla?
Oh, fabulous. He was such a great guy. And, you know, the first time they had me do color with him, and I think that was at Boston Garden, because, you know, back then we had superstars, we had challenge, you know, at prime time, they used matches everywhere, not TV ones, but they'd drop in the other shows. So I'm going to do color, and, you know, I had obviously met Gorilla, knew him, but, you know, this is a little different when you're doing color with Gorilla Monsoon. And he said, look, he goes, we're here to just enhance, not overshadow the matches. When you've got something, if I'm talking, just jump in, pat me on the leg, or if you've got something, I'll be quiet. He was unbelievable to work with. He was just so easy and so welcoming that he couldn't do enough. He was just fabulous to work with.
That's great. Gorilla is another one that we don't get to hear nearly as much about as we'd like. And he's him and Heenan always a great team together.
I'll tell you what, Hunter and Colt, and this is the honest truth, that even though, you know, a lot of the matches and interviews I had done either with Gorilla or the interviews that aired on primetime, if I was home or somewhere, I would still watch it just for the byplay between Bobby and Gorilla.
Yeah. Yep.
How do you not? Yeah, it's just, that's to this day probably the best announce team you can think of in the business, right? I mean,
definitely one of the greatest.
How do you argue with Gorilla and Bobby?
I mean, you know, certainly, you know, Jim Ross and Jerry Lawler, the King, were great, but Hunter, I agree with you that, much like I said about Gordon Solie, there's a lot of good ones, but Gordon was the GOAT.
Yeah.
Yep.
And there have been a lot of great announce teams, but Bobby and Gorilla just a cut above.
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely. So after you leave the WWF, you actually start doing announcing for... No problem. You start doing announcing work for the Ladies Professional Wrestling Association.
Right.
I don't know anything about that. Tell me a little bit about the Ladies Professional Wrestling Association.
I got a call from a gentleman named Tor Berg, who was running it. He was, you know, it took him a long time to track me down. And he started it. It was out of Las Vegas, and he wanted an all women's promotion, but not gimmickry. I mean, we treated it, you know, very serious. They brought Adnan in as a manager. They had great women's stars. I mean, I had worked with them in the AWA and WWF. Judy Martin and Lonnie Kai were there, Rock and Robin, Heidi Lee Morgan, Misty Blue Sims, the Nasty Girls, Susan Sexton, Dawn Salvey, Brittany Brown. But I mean, everything was done no different than a men's organization. So it was, you know, really well done. And really the problem was, again, back then, there was no superstation. So the show had to be syndicated to every single market. They got it on Madison Square Garden Network. And I also, just from my sales background, helped with a lot of the syndication. We sent out tapes to station managers. And a lot of times I would talk to the general manager and they say, look, we love the show. I think this would do great But the station owner back then just has a problem of putting women beating up other women on TV.
Yeah.
So it was just hard, and eventually, you know, a lot of it back then, it was a barter system. Well, if you didn't have all the top markets, it was hard to sell your half of the commercials. So, financially, it ran for a few years and just kind of, you know, ran its course. Medusa was in it for a while. I mean, they had, you know, great people and great, great matches that, you know, are still out there. But it was really, you know, Glow with David McLean was kind of going on at the same time, but that was a little more, you know, the women were more scantily clad.
Yeah.
And this was pro wrestling. A great story about LPWA that still kind of ties into wrestling today. Lisa Moretti, who went on to be Ivory, was a WWE Hall of Famer, she came over. And she was going to start wrestling for us. Well, we didn't really know how good in ring she was coming out of Glow. And we didn't really know how we were going to use her. We were doing a taping in Laughlin, Nevada, Don Laughlin's Hotel and Casino. And, you know, Tor and I would set the matches. A lot of times Lonnie and Judy would sit in, we'd go through the finishes, decide who was going to be pushed. So first we were back and forth on whether she should be a baby face or a heel, and just looking at her and her size, and I said, I think she'd be better as a baby face. And, you know, let's give her a push. She had the look, and she was, you know, very personable and great, and, you know, you could tell even before she wrestled, she was there to try and make herself better. So we were trying to figure out, okay, who are we going to put her with? And, you know, old school talent, Judy said, I'll work with her. Okay, great. So we made the match, and I'll never forget, you know, we had no idea, you know, if Tina would get over. And she was wrestling as Tina Moretti. And Judy had come out to the ring first, and she was in a, you know, an established heel. And then, you know, Tina came out, you know, from behind the curtain, I forget, you know, whatever music she had. And she just had that it factor. She was over with the crowd before the bell rang, just the way she interacted walking to the ring. She was over, and I said to myself, she's going to do very well and go far in this business. And it was just, it's like, you can push someone, you can't. If they don't have the it factor, if they don't have the ability to get themselves over, it's just not going to work. But she had it from day one.
Wow. Well, and you see, that's why things like that with the LPWA are important, because, you know, even if, like I said, you know, I don't necessarily know anything of the history of the promotion. It's a platform to build stars for the future. So that's what we've been talking about recently too with independent wrestling, is just being able to be there to help build the next generation.
You know, I got a chance later on and work some with an independent here called Steel Domain. I have, and everyone should, the greatest admiration for the guys that are working independents just starting out. You know, they could be wrestling in front of 150 people, but they give the maximum effort like they were wrestling in front of 20,000 at Madison Square Garden. Yep. And that's not something easy to do. So pushing the independents is great because, you know, they're working for little or no money, but giving the absolute maximum effort to because they love to entertain.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And a big part of building future stars is amateur wrestling. And I see here that in 1996, you were appointed to the Minnesota Amateur Sports Commission by the governor, and then reappointed by Jesse Ventura and Tim Pawlenty.
I served five terms for a total of 15 years.
How does that come about that you get appointed to something like that?
A friend of mine was involved with Governor Arne Carlson. I had done all the wrestling, and he called one day, and there was an opening. The Amateur Sports Commission, there was one commissioner for each congressional district in the state, and it was a three-year term. We ran the National Sports Center in Blaine, which back then and still today has the largest youth soccer tournament in the world. I think last year they had teams from like 18 different countries. Wow. And he said, you know, do you have much of an interest in, you know, amateur athletics? I said, well, yeah, I mean, I love, you know, I didn't go to school there, but, you know, I'm a big Golden Gopher fan, love the Gophers. Still like to, you know, go to high school games. And where did that come from? And then he told me about the, you know, Amateur Athletic Commission. And he said, would you be interested in that? And I said, well, shit, yeah, absolutely. So they did a legislative background check. And suddenly I was appointed. And it was interesting. It allowed me to reunite because Herb Brooks was also on the Amateur Sports Commission.
Oh.
And you know, when I went to my first meeting in the National Sports Center, you know, I met with the executive director ahead of time, you know, just catching me up to speed, how things work, you know, what we vote on, things. You know, besides that, the Giant Ski Ridge in Boabit, Minnesota, the Highland Park Ski Jump. So now we go into the meeting, and he said, oh, let me take you over. Herb Brooks is also a commissioner. So he's taking me over like he's going to introduce me. And Herbie looks up, Kenny, big hug. And he's going like, huh? It was great. And then he had appointed me. And at the end of my first 3 years when my term was up, Jesse was governor. And I got a call from his chief of staff, and he said, Governor wanted me to talk to you about the Amateur Sports Commission. And I'm thinking, you know, like every politician, when you get to appoint people to things, you have a lot of people you're beholden to that helped you get elected in the campaign. Mm-hmm. And I remember saying, look, tell the governor, I fully understand he's got his people, you know, totally understand, you know, wish him all the best. And he said, no. The question is, would you be willing to serve another term? And I said, well, sure, but I understand. He said, no, I understand. Governor said if he wants to serve, he's reappointed.
Wow.
So Arne Carlson appointed me, and then Jesse reappointed me twice, and then Tim Pawlenty reappointed me twice.
Wow.
So it was great that we were involved in the State High School League. We started a lot of kids hockey tournaments, and I mean, it was really rewarding, so I truly enjoyed it. But that's how the whole thing came about.
Well, and Colt is involved as a coach for youth athletics, specifically girls wrestling, and helps out with all sorts of stuff. Is there any message that you would want to put out there to some of the younger people watching? Because we do have some high schoolers, middle schoolers that watch. Do you have any message about youth athletics?
You know what it would be? Winning is certainly, you know, all important, but you need to be doing it for the right reason, that you love it and want to do it, and make sure you take time to have fun while you're doing it. Train hard, practice hard, take the time to enjoy it, because you get opportunities while you're younger, because there are a lot of youth teams, depending on your skill level, it gets a little harder to be on organized teams. And, you know, your parents are taking you everywhere, but never lose sight of the fact and do it as long as you're having fun doing it.
Yeah,
that's a good message. My kids that I coach in a middle school weight room, I coach on a football field, and I coach in the girls wrestling room. And I encourage all the kids that this is something that should be fun, and it should not be so, you know, you shouldn't be so serious or so focused on one thing. You should be able to have fun with it and enjoy it, especially some of those things like weightlifting we can do for as long as we absolutely can. Football, we have a very short time. And so, you know, I encourage the kids to have fun. So I do appreciate that message. That is a good one.
Well, you know, Cole, that's great to hear, because there are a lot of youth coaches today that some don't think that way. It's
no.
all about winning. And, you know, they're coaching like it's Division One college athletics.
Yes.
That's great that, you know, you emphasize the fun part. Because I know, you know, some parents, that they push their kids so that if the child isn't enjoying it, they're afraid to say they don't want to do it anymore.
Yep. Yep. And that's, I want them to have fun. I want them to learn the basics. I don't, you know, like the weight room, we don't overcomplicate anything. It's the basics, and I want to keep kids safe so they can do that stuff for many, many years, because I'm 44, I think. I forget how old I am, but, you know, I still weightlift.
You must be older than that, Cole, because when you're old enough to start forgetting your age, it's got to be more than 40.
I quit paying attention to my birthdays when I turned 21, so.
It's like, hey, I'm legal, I can do everything from here
yep,
on.
I'm good now, so. But, no, I appreciate that message. That is great, so.
And just to kind of tie everything together here, I do want to ask you about the Hall of Fame. How did you find out that you were going to be going into this year's 2026 class of the Trigos Thez Hall of Fame in Waterloo?
It was so incredible. Back when I started in the AWA in 83, that's when Medusa first started as well. And we formed, for whatever reason, a wonderful friendship that has continued over the years. I mean, we would go to lunch, we would go out to dinner, we would go to games. You know, she was just someone I absolutely looked forward to spending time with whenever I got the opportunity. I had seen her a few months before at the gathering in Charlotte, and it was like the promoter said, as soon as she got there, said, first thing, where's Kent? And, you know, I was down at the banquet, she came and looking for me, and we dragged the photographer out to take pictures of us. You know, we had a great time, although I don't know if the photographer has quite recovered yet. And it was a few months later, I want to say like November or December, I was home, I was watching a game, and I got a text, and I just glanced down on it. It said, hey, it's Medusa, do you have a minute to talk? And I, you know, I texted her back, for you I've got way more than a minute, but I wasn't sure if it was her, somebody pulling a prank or whatever. But like 30 seconds later, my phone rang, and it came up with, you know, her name, so I knew it was really her. And I thought she just thought of me and was calling, and we talked for a second. She said, listen, I've got some exciting news. And I said, what? And she goes, well, you're supposed to be officially notified, you know, but I'm on the board for the Trigos Thez Hall of Fame. And I thought she was telling me she'd just been appointed. So I said, oh, that's great. Congratulations. You'd be wonderful. She said, no, I've been on the board. She said, I'm calling to tell you, you're going in the Hall of Fame this year. She was so excited to tell me, and I'm hearing it from someone that has been a wonderful friend that I look forward to talking to and seeing whenever the opportunity. So that made it all that much more. She said, we just voted today, they're supposed to notify you, but I told them I'm calling them.
That's awesome.
That's what I found out.
That's great. That's that's in keeping in what we know with Medusa. She'll get very excited and not.
Well, I mean, hearing news of that magnitude, that, you know, I truthfully, I was so shocked because I never even thought I would be on the their radar.
Yeah.
That she wanted to be the one that called, and that she was so excited to tell me made it all that much better. In fact, I just she called and we talked Saturday for close to an hour. You know, one of the things since we're talking about her that I don't think gets talked about enough, and I was so lucky to witness it, you know, from ringside when Medusa and Sherry Martel were both in the AWA. Their matches were so incredible, but they brought, I guess I would say, a physicality to women's wrestling, not trying to hurt each other, but just a physicality and a physical side to the matches that had not really been there before.
Yeah.
That, you know, people were like, wow. And so I always kind of say that it was Medusa and Sherry that kind of ushered in the glory years of, you know, what became the Diva division. And I mean, you know, let's face it, some of the biggest stars in wrestling are women. And I don't know if those two get the credit that they deserve, because they kind of created that.
They brought a legitimacy to their matches, and it made it feel, like you said, more physical. It made it feel more real. And she's definitely one of those, we would say, pioneers. And we enjoyed being able to talk to her when we got her here a month ago or so.
Oh, she's wonderful. And I am so happy because... I asked her, I don't know if I'm supposed to say anything, but if I get in trouble, I get in trouble. at the Hall of Fame induction, Medusa is going to be the one that presents me.
Oh, very cool.
That's
very
awesome.
Nice.
So, yeah, I mean, when you have one of the goats doing it, and then it's a goat that's a wonderful friend that you love, is going to make it all that much more special.
Absolutely. Yep. Cool. Love it.
That's so great to hear. And Ken, again, congratulations on your induction this year. We look forward to seeing you at the Hall of Fame weekend. We'll be there.
You're both going to be there?
Oh, absolutely. We're both going to be there.
Oh, yeah.
We'll be there for everything.
Oh, yep.
Oh, wonderful. I look forward to meeting you. And I have got so many in family and friends that are coming. I mean, I can't wait. It's just going to be amazing. And I'm so honored. And hey, you know, plug, you guys need a plug where people can still get tickets for it. I mean, it's just an incredible event.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we'll put the link up on screen, but also in the description of this video, we'll have the link for your all access passes, being able to get a listing of the events, check out more details, book your hotel, the affiliate with the Hall of Fame, because it's a big weekend and there's a lot of fun stuff going on, and we're excited to be able to cover those events. We're excited to come and get to meet guys like you, Ken, because this is what wrestling's all about, and we're really excited for... Well,
there's going to be, you know, Iowa was certainly AWA territory, and for people that are thinking about coming, there's going to be a great... I think it is Friday early afternoon. You'll have to check the schedule. But the Hall of Fame is going to be doing an AWA panel that is going to be featuring Medusa, Jimmy Garvin, of course, is being inducted into the same class. I think Greg Gagne is going to be part of it. I'm going to be part of it, as is George Shire, the great AWA historian. So if you're an AWA fan, that should proved to be interesting.
Oh, yes. Yeah, we're looking forward to all of this. Like I said earlier, you know, sitting under that learning tree, that whole weekend is going to be amazing. So
absolutely.
If you're sitting under a tree, make sure there's no bird on the branch.
That's right. Well, Ken, we want to respect your time. Thank you so much for this interview. We really appreciate it. With that, we'll come to a close.
Thank you so much for having me. It was an honor. I appreciate it and enjoyed being here.
Absolutely. Anytime. For Colt Powers, I've been Hunter Dietz. Thank you so much, Ken. We appreciate it. And this has been Between the Ropes and On the Go Media Podcast production.